Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Hey, Francis.
How are you this morning?
Doing all right.
You know, we got a bunch of very positive emails.
We did.
We've been telling bartender stories. And we got a flurry of people saying, oh, come on, give us more bartender
Not
stories.
Not just bartender stories, telling all kinds of restaurant, fun, behind-the-scenes kinds of
stories.
So
I got a funny story.
You have one.
I have one from our past.
You have a funny story?
You were the bartender.
Uh-oh.
You were the bartender, and there was a person at the bar. It was a gentleman you threw out. It was a gentleman you showed through the air exit. Of a bar,
yes,
many years ago.
Yes, I recall the gentleman.
And the air exit from the bar, which is on the first floor, was when you picked him up by his collar and his belt.
Rare, you know, it, collar, belt, head opens the door.
No, you
know,
you used his chest to open the door.
The person's head opens the door, chest opens the door, and out they do go.
There was a gentleman that came into the bar late one evening. It wasn't our bar. It was when we worked at a different bar. The gentleman came into the bar, and it was late on a weeknight, and very often we would get people from the different theaters that would come in to hang out at the bar. And the Crossroads Theater was a wonderful theater that was in New Brunswick. It was an African-American theater.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was like late on a Tuesday or something, and so there was nobody up in the bar. Crossroads let out, the theater let out, the patrons came over, had one drink, they went home, and then the staff came
right,
over.
Right, after everybody would break down, they'd
And
the
this was a regular thing.
Very,
these were our
very
regular
frequent.
Customers.
Great,
so
great
the,
friends.
The staff of the George Street Playhouse was friends of ours. The staff of the Crossroads Theater were friends of ours. Because, you know, when people who work at night, you'll find very often that nurses, emergency room nurses, cops,
there's only a certain sector of the community that's awake and out at 2 a.m.
Right, exactly.
You know, you're going to congregate.
We have a lot of friends who work at night.
Mm-hmm.
So, and theater people are in that mix. And so the bar was, 98% African American clientele.
Yes,
because it was empty, and then the staff of Crossroads Theater walked in.
Right.
And so this guy walks in who's not African-American, and he's had too many drinks. He walks up to the bar, and he says, I'll have a scotch.
I think
And Mark says, how about a Coke? And the guy says, you cut me off. And then Mark
I said,
says,
how about a cup of coffee?
Yeah. So,
hot chocolate? Can I get you some cocoa? Anything.
So Mark says, no, I can't serve you any more alcohol, sir. And the guy looks down at the bar, and he sees everybody, you know, having a good time, and he says, you mean you're going to serve? And he uses a racial epithet.
A bad one.
And you're okay. Not going to serve me? So Mark says, well, now not only am I not going to serve you, now I'm going to throw you out.
And I broke the golden rule, okay? I broke the golden rule. But
I was there to watch the bar for
sure.
You. So Mark comes out from behind the bar, he's like, you got to go. Guy doesn't go. Mark doesn't lose a minute, comes out from behind the bar, and literally picks the guy up by his collar and the back of his belt and opens the door and throws him out. And so, you know, he takes the airplane fly out onto the street, and our folks from Crossroads were all like,
why are you throwing that guy out?
What did he do?
You don't want to know.
You don't want to know.
Never mind. Let him go.
Anyway, so Mark finally tells them, and they're like, oh, he did? He said what? And the guy turns up outside.
He's looking through the front windows.
He's yelling.
Like screaming at the front windows. But we can't hear him because he's through windows.
So everybody in the bar starts taunting him back, like pointing at their drinks, like we're having a great time and all, right? And then finally, one woman who's probably on the verge of having had too much to drink says, he's got a gun! Okay, so the entire bar jumps, lays down on the floor, crawls into the closet. Mark is laying on the floor behind the bar.
I am actually under the bar, reaching up for the telephone.
So Mark's little hand
so
is reaching around for the telephone.
It's a big hand, but if I'm going to get shot, I'm going to, you know, it's going to be through the hand. That's the only shot there is.
So everybody's laying down. And so Mark looks up at the woman who said this and says, you know, Ms. X, get down. She says, what? Get down. And she says, why? And he says, because he's got a gun. And she says, Who's got I got?
She made a joke that she didn't remember 45 seconds
later. We don't know if it was a joke or not, and I don't think it was a joke, because then we did call the cops. The cops arrived, and we went out, and he was taunting the people
at the bar next door.
They were coming out, and there was a crowd around his car, and the police arrived and defused the situation. So I don't know if he had a gun or not.
That was one of those great moments, though, where he left the front of our bar and walked down the street. And, you know, and bartenders, as we do, we're friends. Like, I called the bar of the other place.
Don't let this guy in.
And I said, hello, Tony. See the guy walking in the door right now? Look. Oh, yeah, I see a guy. Is he staggering a little? Yeah.
Flag him.
Don't serve him. He's trouble.
I love working in this small town.
So Francis asked me to come up with a story. You know, he said, think about it. We're getting all these requests to come up with bartender stories. And one of the great stories... I was working, it was New Year's Eve, and it was one of those open bar setups where you came in, you paid your $29, and you got to drink like a fish all night long. Okay?
Ah, the 80s.
And it was back in the days where cutting people off was not as important as it is today, period.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And, you know, you didn't know that how important it was. So I'm bartending like I have never bartended before. And I'm making drinks, and I'm hustling, and I'm going. And I'm working with one of those guys, okay? One of those guys who's just a slug, okay? And you've all had, you know, realize when you're a bartender, you're splitting tips with the guy you work next to. And if he's great, it's great. And if he stinks, it stinks, period, okay?
So he's not carrying his weight.
Oh, I would say he's making somewhere between 10 and 12% of the drinks, and he's not upholding any of the conversations either, because again, part of the bartender's job is to be a conversationalist. So I'm making drinks as fast as I can, Don't even see him behind the bar for a little while. I go, you know, one of the taps runs out. I run to the tap room and I go to change a keg, and he's sitting on a keg smoking a cigarette. What are you doing? Oh, having a cigarette break. Get out of here and get back in there and start making... Okay, at the rate you make drinks, you can't... Okay, you can't take a break. You're on break all the time.
Right.
Okay? So anyway, midnight comes, the owner of the restaurant says, you know what? You guys are working really hard. He's talking to me. And why don't you guys, at midnight, have a celebratory drink with everybody when they have a shot. Okay? So whatever, I'm like, I don't have time to have a shot. I'm making my drinks. Okay, this guy decides he's going to do a flaming shot of Zambuca.
What an amateur.
Okay. Now, flaming shots, not really a great idea. Okay, but
right.
Whatever he's going to do.
For any number of reasons.
So you blow it out and you drink it. Well, this guy doesn't blow it out. Not only does he not blow it out, he doesn't pour it in his mouth just to deplete it of oxygen. He pours it all over his face. Okay? So his face is on flaming Sambuca fire. Okay? He is a light. Okay?
A
word that you just don't get to use in this circumstance very often. He is a light.
Uh-huh.
Put his little face out, spends the rest of his night with the face in the ice. End of the night, comes upstairs. Oh, my face hurts. Takes half the tips, walks out the door.
Oh, no. See
I that? Hate you. Okay, to this day, here, if you're listening, I hate you.
See, I tell you, the difference between you and me is he would not have gotten my half of those tips. You can be 100% certain. All right, we'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:15. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Cafe Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. Our guest today is Warren Belasco. Warren is a professor of American Studies at the University of Maryland. He's the author of The Appetite for Change, How the Counterculture Took on the Food Industry, and Americans on the Road from Auto Camp to Motel. And he's also co-editor of Food Nation's Selling Taste in Consumer Society. So he's quite an authority on food overall. His current book is Meals to Come, A History of the Future of Food.
Warren, welcome to the show.
Yeah, hi, Mark.
So, Warren, this book was full of some. This is a bit. We'll put this in the category of big ideas. This would not be the cookbook show. This is the big ideas book. What is the history of the future of food?
The history of the future of food is really a hundreds or perhaps thousands of years of worrying about whether there's going to be enough. I think that's probably the biggest idea, and it's an idea that we tend to downplay now because we have so much, but I think for most of history, that was the main concern, was scarcity, and particularly with population growing in the last few hundred years, particularly, will the Earth's resources be able to meet the needs of the future?
Well, you detail in your book a number of times throughout our history that scientists, government officials, and thinkers the end of the food supply, or the food supply not keeping pace with population, and then every time that we've come up against that end, where a Malthusian crisis would be necessary, it doesn't have to happen, and we do indeed wind up with enough food. Are there any assurances that that's always going to be the case? Are we always going to have enough food?
Well, the optimists, which I call the cornucopian position, have always believed that, yeah, we'll pull one out of the fire, basically, or a magic out of the rabbit out of the hat. And they have.
I get it, the rabbit out of a hat. We'll start eating all the rabbits. They reproduce quickly.
Right. I think that what's been said about the Malthusian argument, the one fear that we're going to run out, is that they only have to be right once.
Yeah.
And they have been, I think you could say, well, I'm very impressed by the Malthusian argument, mainly because it is concerned that there is a limit to everything, and ultimately there has to be a cost paid for the banquet.
But at the same time, wouldn't you say that there's a natural limit to the number of people that would be on the Earth? I mean, isn't that self-limiting at the same time?
Only if they run out of food so we can't make anymore.
Right. That's probably the limit. That's always been the concern, and in my book I trace a lot of these calculations, and people have spent a lot of hours a lot of careers trying to calculate exactly how many people can the Earth support, and they've ranged from 2 billion. There were predictions not so long ago that, God, if we reach 2 billion, that would be the end.
So we're pretty glad that they weren't right.
We're over 6.5 now, and then there are others who will say, oh, no, we can accommodate, 3 trillion. So there's quite a range of variation in those calculations.
That's a pretty big range.
Where do you come down after having spent so much time exhaustively, examining the various hypotheses?
Well, I tend not to be an immediate scaremonger, in the sense that there's a lot of food out there right now. And then that's the other thing. There's a third position on the hunger issue, in addition to the arguments that we can just, through science, we can produce more, or that we're just going to eat ourselves into oblivion through overpopulation. The third argument is that there is enough food, but it just needs to be distributed better, and that's more of a political and economic issue than one of science or natural limits.
Well, I think there are two issues here, and one of them is, what about the food right now? And we know now that we have the ability to produce enough food to feed everybody on the planet. And so right now, what we have is a distribution problem and an equity problem and a political problem of economics. There's enough food to feed everybody. There's no reason for the people who go hungry at night to go hungry. The question that's interesting, though, is, when it becomes is there a point where it will become impossible to produce enough food to feed everybody, regardless of how it's distributed?
In theory, I think there would be, and I think we're facing a number of uncertainties about that, particularly with climate change, whether that will impact on resources, on the ability to grow food. I mean, some have tried to see the bright side of it, the silver lining, and saying, well, maybe that will actually improve agricultural productivity in northern places. But I think a lot of other people are afraid of the weather and flooding and so forth, and that might very well impact on food production. I think there are two other things that a lot of the worriers are concerned about, and one is water, for which there does seem to be a finite amount, and competition for water between food and population is very intense, and the farmers are losing out in a lot of the world, so that's a major issue. And then the other thing is oil. Basically, our modern industrial agricultural system is based on oil, and you know that leads to that whole debate: are we at peak oil, or are we going to be there soon?
We want to take a short break. We're going to come back and talk more with Warren Velasco, and I want to talk about the relationship between agriculture and oil and how interrelated they are. It may surprise you. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:25.
Floors, walls, and lighting. The Restaurant Guys learned long ago that the key to making a space look great are floors, walls, and lighting. There's no tougher test to a carpet than a busy restaurant. From design to installation to cleaning, the Gillespie Group has handled the Restaurant Guys restaurant floors for more than 10 years. Designers know what looks great on the first day. Bob Gillespie knows what will continue to look great year after year. Gillespie doesn't just install carpets. Their quality clean division has experience and expertise to keep that carpet looking great. In our business, it's the details that matter. In your home or office, the details make a lasting impression. The Gillespie Group handles projects from large hotels to offices right down to your living room. Look down. Go on, look down. Right there by your feet. You see. You need the Gillespie Group. Call them at 732-254-5508 or visit them at thegillespiegroup.com. Tell them the Restaurant Guys sent you and get a free cleaning with any installation. Remember, it's Gillespie for carpet and flooring, 732-254-5508.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis, talking with Warren Velasco, author of Meals to Come, A History of the Future of Food, a really smart book that you should pick up. You can find it how on our website, restaurantguysradio.com. Warren, before the break, we were talking about the relationship between oil and our modern way that we farm. And we've read from a number of sources that in our modern farming, we've changed the paradigm from all of history, where all species try to get more calories out of food than it takes to get the food. We, in using oil, and whether it's through creating the pesticides or creating the fertilizers or using the tractors or the transport, we generally spend about 7 calories between what human beings expend in effort and what we use in fossil fuels.
And the energy we use.
To get 1 calorie of food. Is that simply unsustainable?
I think it is. I think that using oil as our energy source, now there are others who would say, well, if we can figure out better ways to translate solar energy being the ultimate source of all of this, oil itself is stored solar energy. If we could figure out better ways to get the sun's calories into human, food, those resources are infinite.
Clearly at some point we're going to need to come up with a different energy source. I mean, whether you say it's, you hear some people say 2028 we're going to run out of oil, 2075 we're going to run out of oil. We'll have 200 more years of oil. Whichever the case may be, at some point we're going to come up with we're going to need to come up with another energy source.
Right, and you don't have to necessarily be an extreme environmentalist to buy into that. I mean, there are the cornucopians who have been looking for years for ways perhaps to redesign plants and animals so that they are more efficient converters of energy into food. And the example that I was particularly amused by came from the 1920s, where there were people calculating that, the average leaf only converts maybe 1% of the solar energy that falls on it. The rest of it is just wasted. And boy, if we could redesign the leaf or the plant or the plant cell.
When we come back after the news, we're going to talk about how indeed farming is. We are redesigning the cells in what could be a very disturbing way. Genetic engineering offers some great promise and it offers some great risk. And we'll be talking more about that after the news with Warren Velasco, author of Meals to Come, A History of the Future of Food. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:30.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to the Restaurant Guys, a I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together we own Stage Left and Capitol Lombardi Restaurants. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Warren Belasco is the professor of American Studies at the University of Maryland. He's author of several books on food. His current book that we're talking about today is Meals to Come, A History of the Future of Food. We were talking before the news, Professor Belasco, about people wanting to, I guess the larger topic is there are the optimists or the cornucopians, as you call them in your book, that say, listen, they've predicted the end of the world, hundreds of times, and it's never happened, so ignore that. And there are the Malthusians or the doomsdayers who say, well, yeah, but the doomsdayer's only got to be right once, and it's over. And I think that in warfare, people would say, oh, yeah, there are always wars and we always recover. Well, that was before we had nuclear weapons. You know, the next war, if it's an all-out war between nuclear powers, is going to be the last one. And I think there may be a corollary you can make with genetically engineered animals and crops and food products. Somebody makes a big mistake with a genetically engineered something that can reproduce itself. And there are some tremendous risks associated with that. How does genetic engineering play into your arguments that you've seen?
Well, the law, that's always been part of the pessimistic view of the future, which goes even before genetic engineering appeared, which is that, the killer grass gets out of control and just chokes everything, or the killer tomatoes, that whole thing. And I think there's some legitimacy to that. I mean, there have been a lot of cases in the history of technologies that where we have unintended consequences, or I just call it oops, the oops factor. Well, we didn't really think of that one.
And sometimes they're beneficial, but sometimes they're not.
It's part of the risk, and I think any legitimate scientist knows that. There's a lot of uncertainties when you... particularly when you play around with genes. I tend to think this is what part of the book. I look at a lot of science fiction views of the future, which I think for many people is their primary text, you might say, on the future. And while there are many optimistic ones, the Jetsons kind of future and Star Trek and those kind, for the most part in the 20th century, the best science fiction writers and filmmakers have been pretty gloomy, and they've been sketching a lot of scenarios like that, of technology running amok. And so we have, I think that has influenced the view of biotechnology, of the Frankenfoods idea. And there's Mary Shelley almost 200 years ago writing Frankenstein, which is basically the same story of ingenious scientists playing God with life and look what you get, a runaway monster. And I think we're still living with that frame today. And there have been examples of it, and they are indeed scary.
I think one of the interesting things about how this all works out is that, you know, you only need one mistake when you're talking about in something where the possible catastrophe is so huge, even if you have a one in a million shot of making a mistake, and I mean you weigh the potential consequences against the potential benefits.
If you do that a million times, chances are you're going to end the world.
Or if I said, listen, you got a one in a million shot. If I do this, the world, you know, you're going to get $1 million. Do you play the lottery? Yes. If I say there's a one in a million shot, you're going to end the world if this comes in. Do you roll the dice? And I think the answer is probably no. What the corporate agribusiness companies and the people who believe strongly that we need genetic engineering or purport to believe it, but and have an economic interest in wanting to use genetic engineering. Oh, they always talk about using it to enhance the food supply. So Monsanto makes Roundup Ready corn is their first genetic product, and Roundup Ready soybeans and Roundup Ready canola. What they always say in their arguments, even though these Roundup Ready products don't have any greater yield than the other products, that if we don't embrace genetic engineering,
there won't be enough food.
We can't feed the planet. Is there any merit to that?
I think that they use the rhetoric of feeding the hungry, and this is a long-standing part of the debate.
Warren, I want you to know that rhetoric is a charged word.
Yes, and I'm that's what I study, really, or the academics call it discourse. In answer to the Malthusian pessimists, the cornucopians are always saying, well, we need technology to feed the hungry, otherwise indeed starve.
But in this case, the cornucopians stand to make more money if you use their products.
That's where I think many, and I didn't certainly haven't come up with this insight, but there's a certain misdirection in the whole, that there is indeed biotechnology out there that could feed the hungry, and there are parts of the world that where people really are in very desperate circumstances, and where small changes in plants or animals could make a big difference in their food supply, particularly in Africa. But Roundup Ready corn is probably not the product. So what the argument has been that the biotech companies use the feed the hungry argument, but basically they're trying to feed their shareholders with products that are going to be used in the richest countries, where we already have too much corn. We don't need more corn. We don't need to produce more. But
we're paying farmers not to grow corn.
I am an American, and I have no problem with appeasing your shareholders and the stock system and big companies trying to make money. But you can't do that to the detriment of the rest of the population.
Well, and actually the shareholders are suffering because the rest of the world, I think Americans are risk takers, the high rollers. I think Las Vegas is part of our culture, but a lot of the rest of the world is much more cautious and particularly about technology. So we're in the situation with Europe and indeed Japan and other places importing American food, where they won't take our products because they're afraid of the biotechnology that's in them. So there's a real split in the world. I look mostly at American sources, but if you go over to England, they're much more, and France, much gloomier about a lot of these modern technologies than we are, and much more of a Malthusian mindset.
Well, but these are the same guys that are playing with fire. And in the same time they're playing with fire, they're saying, listen, there are so many safeguards in place that this could never escape. This could never get out. You know, genetically modified salmon would never get out of the oceans, except it does. And genetically modified corn could never find itself into the regular corn stock that goes to Europe, but it did. And, you know, genetically modified corn that's not even approved, that was grown by Bayer, that's not even approved for human consumption, could never escape, except it's
rice.
In the food supply.
Mm-hmm.
Rice. Except it's in the food supply. So, you know, it rings a little hollow when they say, you know, all these safeguards are in place, and I understand the Europeans' reticence.
Yeah, I do too, and also our own. I think faith in government at this point, I'm a historian, so I look at how people's attitudes change over time. In the 60s or in the 50s, there was a huge amount of trust in the federal regulation. But now I think we're, you know, because of the general view of Washington and government in general, having failed us in so many ways, the trust me or trust government argument is not working as well. And I think there is a lot of that even within our own culture. We're not in a very optimistic time now.
And again, when you're talking about the odds being, well, maybe this will return twice as much return on our crops as last year, and maybe it'll return half as much, that's very different than maybe we'll get two or three times as many crops, or maybe
we'll have none.
Or maybe they won't be able to grow corn anymore anywhere on the planet. You know, it's a very different paradigm. We're going to come back more in just a moment and talk more with Warren Belasco about his wonderful book, Meals to Come, A History of the Future of Food. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 1145.
Let me talk to you about lighting, and specifically about how you can enhance the appeal of any space. Lighting is a powerful, emotional, and aesthetic force. It's one of the most important elements of design. More than anything else, it sets the mood and tone for an entire experience. A room pops or it doesn't based on lighting. Lights on 9 is a top-notch commercial and retail lighting supplier. Lights on 9 supplied all the lights for our award-winning Catherine Lombardi restaurant, inside and out, dining room and kitchen. Lights on 9 has everything from tasteful and stylish chandeliers to table and floor lamps to outdoor lighting for illuminating a building or walkway or a sign. At Lights on 9, the service is exemplary, expert, and knowledgeable. They ship anywhere in the continental United States for free.
Their retail store is in the Galleria Shopping Center on Route 9 in Manalapan. They're open 7 days a week. Call them at 732-308-9166. That's 732-308-9166. Or visit them at lightson9.com. That's lightson, the number 9.com.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Francis and Mark of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick, New Jersey. Our guest is Warren Belasco. He is the author of a wonderful book called Meals to Come, A History of the Future of Food. Warren, you wrote a book about the history of what people have been saying about the future of food was going to be in different time periods, which I think is pretty fascinating. It's a history of how people predicted the future from the 1890s right through the 1980s. You know, we had things like people were saying that we were going to hit that Malthusian limit in the 70s, and we met that, or in the 40s and 50s, and we met that with the Green Revolution in the 60s, where we began to produce more food per acre through science. And optimists say, you know, we'll always be able to pull some rabbit out of the hat, and pessimists say, you know what, okay, we dodged a bullet last time, that doesn't mean we can dodge a bullet next time. What is our current view of the future of food, and what's your view, having looked at it so in depth, of where we're going or what the possible futures of food are in the world?
Well, I may dodge that one, because as a historian, I try to look at where we've come. I don't know.
We'll just ask it again, Warren, if you dodge it.
Someone did ask me that question, and they put it as a historical question, which I can answer, which is that, let's say 100 years from now, someone looks back at our time and you know, writes a history of our own time and what and how we were creating the future right now, what would they say about our own? And I have kind of in a typical academic way, you might say, two views. One is, my gosh, they're really having a lot of fun today, and food is just getting so much more interesting, and who would have ever have thought there would be so many types of cuisine and so many types of restaurants?
You're talking about in America?
Yeah, in America. Options galore, and this would never have been predicted, and there's more to come, because, gosh, there's so much creativity and ingenuity out there, and quite a lot of affluence to buy all this food.
And the other option is we're all dead and there's no one to ask the question.
The other option is, I'm not quite sure the world will all be dead, but if the world goes, we'll probably be the last ones to go. But they may look back at our time as sort of like Marie Antoinette at Versailles, and they were having a great time with lavish banquets, and meanwhile the rest of the world is going to hell. And I think that's the concern I would have most, that our future may actually look pretty good at this point, even with the concerns about climate change. We do have enormous wealth and reserves, but there's so much of the world that's really on the margin.
But Rome is burning.
And it wouldn't take very much to throw them off, and we're already feeling some of the effects of that. And if places like Africa, you know, turn into the next source of terrorism, which could very well be happening already in places like Somalia and Sudan. There's going to be a huge price to pay.
Well, one of the raging issues that we find a lot is there are a lot of folks who really believe that the way to the future now, and I think this has been prevalent among some thinkers for a while, is a plant-based diet, is that the most equitable distribution of calories or of food is a plant-based diet, and that meat really skews things wealthy to poor, and that if the third world becomes, as certain third world countries join the first world, if they start eating meat like we eat meat, we're doomed. Is that a prevalent philosophy that's out there now?
It's not prevalent, but it certainly has come of age. That was the subject of the previous book I wrote a while ago called Appetite for Change, which was about the rise of natural foods and organic food consciousness starting in the 60s and on through the 90s. And I think for so long that was considered, you know, that was the hippie crunchy view of the future, that you know, we just have to cut back and use plants more efficiently than feed them to cows, and I think that view has has definitely gained a lot of traction. I still think it's a hard sell for so many people, but not only in the United States but in the world, because what's working against it is that for so many people, as they prosper, they want to eat more meat, and we're seeing that with and more animal products. We're seeing that in Asia right now, is there a huge increase in egg and pork consumption.
I see it on my kitchen table.
But people like Lester Brown, who's one of the more consistent Malthusian forecasters, have been arguing for years that, you know, the true threat is Asia. It used to be that Asia was considered a threat because it was so poor. It was the Malthusian nightmare. But now it's because it's so successful that they want what we have, and it's and a lot of that's going to soak up a lot more of the world's grain than we might have. So even if we cut back, if China doesn't, the world could still be in major difficulty.
So my final question to you, looking at the history of futurists, which is a pretty cool idea for a book, I have to say, Warren, that's a pretty cool way of looking at things. Are futurists always wrong? How often do futurists get it right?
No, I don't think they're always wrong. I
don't have a phaser.
I was a lot of the high tech gee whiz stuff. They're off. Although in some cases they underestimate the power of technology. And a classic example of that is computers, which were never really foreseen the way they have grown. But I think that. I have two things to say about that. First of all, there are people like H.G. Wells. I think he was absolutely brilliant. And if you go back and dig through his works 100
Amazing.
Years ago, he pretty much predicted everything we have today, including little boutique restaurants serving peasant foods to very rich people. And it's kind of the slow food movement in some ways. But the other thing is I fall back on the idea that futurists don't necessarily have to be right, particularly if they can influence the present. People might take steps, particularly the more negative predictions, if they can take steps to prevent the nightmares that are being predicted, then that in itself is a good thing, even though the forecast itself is going to turn out to be wrong.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment with Warren Belasco, author of Meals to Come, A History of the Future of Food. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:55. Hey everybody, welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. We're talking with Warren Belasco about his book, Meals to Come, The History of the Future of Food.
And we haven't scared you guys this much in a long time, so we were due for a show like this. Haven't had one in a few weeks.
In the future of food, and I know that, you know, making predictions of the future, you're a historian, but here's a question. In the future of food, any possibility that we're going to go to the Jetsons, like, pill? To, you know, which no more food, just a pill you
the
take.
The giant resveratrol food. There's all my antioxidants. I'm good to go.
Or is it going to be the Star Trek replicator that gives us everything we want?
Meal of the pill. I mean, that's people always ask me about that because it's the first thing that comes to their mind when you say the future of food, and it just shows how the Jetsons and those kind of shows have really imprinted on us. But I looked into it fairly closely, and it's actually a 19th century idea. And the idea was really to liberate women with the pill from the kitchen.
That happened many years later with a different pill.
Yeah, there are other pills that have done that. But the food pill was one, you know, because cooking being such drudgery for so many people for so long, particularly with the gathering of firewood and all that. And in addition, it would clean up the countryside because we'd get rid of farmers who are just so untidy. And it would just make life much more efficient. So it's really a very progressive idea, and I was kind of charmed by the faith that there would be a meal on the pill.
Well,
but the trouble is that people like food.
Yeah.
Let me
Thank
tell
God.
You, the future of food for me, hopefully, is that I eat more like my grandmother did.
Yeah, future is the past. Hey, man, thanks for coming on the show. The book is really interesting. If people want to find out about it, you can go to our website, restaurantguysradio.com. Warren, thanks a lot.
Okay, Francis and Mark.
It's been a pleasure.
It's been swell. Hope you've enjoyed the hour talking with Warren Belasco about his book, Meals to Come, The History of the Future of Food. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schaff.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 12 noon.